This is chilling music, Bill.
Sure is.
I binge-watched the hell out of this thing, Making of a Murderer, and we have one of the two lawyers featured in Making a Murderer, Jerome Buting. We'll call you Jerry. How are you, Jerry? Awesome. We have your new... First of all, thank you for coming in a little early because we have a press conference that's going to run at 10:30. We didn't want to make you wait. Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. I just told you off the air I was one of millions of people that just got sucked into Making a Murderer. It was sad. It was something I didn't know about the justice system, that things could be skewed so much.
Right.
Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome. And I wrote the book not just to talk about the Avery case, but also to talk about some of the themes that we see in Making a Murderer that unfortunately are common across many cases in the criminal justice system.
Now, a lot of people were saying that the documentarians had a mission. What mission would that be other than to show that sometimes the justice system is skewed?
Yeah, I think they were just trying to shine a light on the system and give people a better look at what really goes on inside their courtrooms. You know, there's been complaints that they left out evidence. That was the prosecution's case. They left out defense evidence too. It was a 6-week trial, and they had to make the editorial judgments that they did based on what they thought was important. I think they drew from the party's attorneys what they thought was important by how much time we spent in our closing argument. And the main issues that we fought over for 6 weeks, the blood, the bones, the key, the bullet, those are pretty well covered and covered with both sides in the documentary.
Would you do me a favor, Jerry, for people who have not seen or know about the case, just give kind of a quick outline of what went on there with the Avery case?
Well, Stephen Avery was, at the time, and thankfully still is, the only DNA exoneree who was wrongly convicted. In his case, spent 18 years in prison before DNA exonerated him. The only exoneree who has then later been charged with a serious crime and convicted of murder. While he was out for 2 years, he filed a lawsuit against the county that prosecuted him in the wrongful conviction. And then suddenly this woman ends up missing, who he had an appointment with that day, who was a photographer, Teresa Halbach, and he then gets charged with her homicide, and it turns out that a good deal of the evidence used against him was actually found, I use that in quotes, by the very same sheriff's department that he was suing.
She worked for Auto Trader, correct?
Yes.
And then she was scheduled to go and take pictures of a vehicle he was selling.
They had a bunch of vehicles on their farm.
Correct.
Yeah.
And yes, she was taking photographs. And, you know, obviously you would think the way it's shown is that the police department would have an axe to grind against Stephen Avery because they wrongfully convicted him before.
Right, and it wasn't just the money that he was trying to get from the county, but also the embarrassment. These officers, you know, were going to and were in the process of being very deeply embarrassed by what he was exposing happened in his first case. But so from the very beginning, it was very suspicious to me when I took over the case that they had done very little investigation of the usual suspects that you find whenever a woman is found murdered. 90-some% of the time, it's the circle of men in her life, her, you know, whether it's a husband, ex-husband, boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, roommates, colleagues, co-workers, those kinds of things. And so little investigation was done of those suspects, and instead it was laser focused on Stephen Avery.
So, as you just pointed out, only 10% of the time is it an outside source. It's almost always somebody that woman has a knowledge of in some way, shape, or form, a friend, a roommate, a neighbor. That's what normally is.
That's typically the case,
yes. How
about
that? Wow.
All right. Dean Strang was your partner in this.
Yes.
Were you a little jealous that he was getting all the attention from the women?
club. He deserved every bit of it. I had a few of my supporters, too.
Yes, you did.
I think he outnumbered me.
You said that there were themes that go on in other cases. What was it about this Avery case that makes it so interesting to anybody who knows it?
Well, one of the most tragic things, the thing that I hear most from people who watch the documentary, is what happened to the 16-year-old Brendan Dassey with, you know, mental limitations and the kinds of techniques that were used to interview him. And sadly, those happen all the time.
They coerced a confession from him, right?
They did.
Yeah. I was telling Bill off the air, he hasn't gotten to that part of it yet, where Brendan Dassey was taken out of school and being questioned with no one, no parent, no one else around.
No lawyer.
Nothing.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, here's a kid who has some developmental issues, and you could clearly see that when he kind of just was trying to agree with them, the way they approached him. He's a kid who just wants to kind of go, okay, yeah, that's how it happened. Listen, am I going to be finished in time to get back to school because I have a test today? That broke my heart.
Yeah, that was one of the most obvious points when he clearly had no idea what he was doing. If he thought, are we going to be done soon so I can go back to my class? I've got a project to turn in. You know, and again, sadly, this happens frequently because of the techniques of interrogation that American law enforcement largely uses. We're now the only country, really, in the English-speaking world that still uses some of these antiquated techniques, and they involve lying to suspects, telling them that they have evidence when they don't, pretending to be a false friend. At one point, one of the detectives in Brendan's case says, you know, yeah, we're police officers, but not right now. I'm really a father with a boy about your age, and I'm here to help you, and we'll go to bat for you, and nothing's going to happen to you, and don't worry about what's going to happen to you. And you know, all these techniques that ultimately, and then they start feeding facts to him with suggestive and leading questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know people falsely confess. A lot of people still have a hard time understanding. You know, they say, hey, I would never falsely confess. You know, why would this guy do it?
When you're in that position, I can't guarantee I wouldn't do it.
Well, and you know, of the DNA exonerations, approximately 25% of the time, those people falsely confessed when we know they didn't do it. They were excluded by DNA. So it happens, and it, in my opinion, it has a higher incidence of happening when there are young people, inexperienced or vulnerable adults who have these particular techniques applied to them.
Are we within our rights to plead the Fifth Amendment and upon being questioned just not respond without an attorney present? We have that right, don't we?
Absolutely. But too often people are made to feel like that's an indication they're guilty.
Oh.
Right.
That only guilty people are the ones who should plead the Fifth or remain silent. And in fact, somebody who's truly innocent has probably the most to lose and the most to risk, mm-hmm. because they may think that the police are being objective and unbiased and on their side, but one of the techniques that they use is essentially the first part of the interview, the police detective is supposed to be like a human lie detector and make his or her own conclusion about whether the suspect is telling the truth. If that person, that detective decides that the person's lying, then it goes into a whole nother phase where they do not accept your denial no matter how long you do it, where they lie, they can present all of these deceptive tricks against you. And studies have shown that police officers are no better than anybody else at telling a lie from a truth.
Yeah.
After watching that particular episode where Brendan Dassey was being asked by authorities about his involvement in the murder, after watching that, I have two teenage boys, and I said to them, if you're ever brought into a principal's office, if you are ever approached by a police officer or brought into the station, be 100% respectful, but say, I just don't feel comfortable talking about this without my mom or dad here. And they can do that. That is their right, and that's not being rude as long as they're, I'm sorry, officer, I just don't feel comfortable talking about this till one of my parents arrives. That's what I told them. I hope that was good advice.
That is good advice, and in part of it's education, a public education that we need to do with our young people. But there's some other things that can be done, and Illinois has taken some early steps in that. Illinois is the first state in the country that now has passed a law that if you are under the age 15, you cannot be interrogated without a lawyer present, and it can't be waived by that young person. They've also now required something that every state should require, which is mandatory recording of all custodial interrogations from beginning to end of anybody under the age 18 charged with felonies. There are some other limitations on the under 15 part of it. The advocates tried to get it to 17, but there was a compromise, and it's a first step. You know, that's one of the things that's one of the ironies here is that it was only 6 months before Brendan Dassey's interrogation came out that Wisconsin changed the law to require those to be videotaped or electronically recorded. That's the only reason we really see what happened in his interrogation, because before that time, and still in many states that don't require them to be videotaped or recorded, detectives will come into court and they will testify. In Brendan's case, it would have been much like Ken Kratz's press conference, where they gave this story and made it sound like this kid was just gave this long narrative, unburdening himself with the guilt he'd been carrying for months, and that it was a coherent story. And we know that wasn't the case. When you actually look at what was said by Brendan, these long pauses, the almost, you know, one or two word responses, you know, the fumbling around, the inconsistencies, all of that stuff is recorded. And it should be, because if we're asking judges and juries to make these kinds of decisions about who's telling the truth or whether a statement was voluntary or coerced, why not give them the best evidence? And that is a videotape recording from beginning to end with no breaks.
Does that include, you said sometimes the police will say something like, I'm not speaking as a police officer, I'm speaking as a father. They have to also tape those incidents or not?
That's right. If the person is in custody, that is not free to leave, in that kind of a setting, they have to record everything.
Which is good. Jerome Buting, Jerry Buting, has written a book, Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. He will be appearing tonight, 7 p.m., Anderson's Bookshop. And
Community Christian Church.
Community Christian Church, that's in Naperville. And you're somewhere today at noon as well.
At the Union League of Chicago.
Okay, we are going to take a break. I believe we might have a press conference. If you're good to stick around, we can continue this. Illusion of Justice, Jerry Buting in the studio with us. It's Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and Jerry Buting is with us. The book is called Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer. If you watch that Netflix original series, you know exactly who Jerry is, and he's going to be at the Union League Club of Chicago at 11:30 a.m. this morning, and out in Naperville at the Community Christian Church through Anderson's Bookshop tonight at 7. Jerry, this is the weirdest interview. We started it, we did a press conference in the middle of it, and now we're back to it. I just want to mention, I feel horrible that Teresa Halbach died. I feel bad that her family was kind of dragged through this when the Netflix documentary came out. But I want to say that you and Dean Strang, I could see the pain that you wanted the truth to come out. And you had a lot of turmoil while working on this case, didn't you?
We did. There's no question. And you know, when we took the case, we knew it was going to be difficult, but by the end, we thought that we had shown more than enough reasonable doubt for a not guilty verdict, and so it was very difficult to get over the loss, knowing that your client is going to prison for the rest of his life unless something changes.
And Brandon Dassey, his conviction was overturned. What's the fate of that now?
Brandon's conviction was overturned by a federal court based in Milwaukee, Eastern District of Wisconsin. But then the state appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is based here in Chicago. They had oral argument just a couple of weeks ago on Valentine's Day, a three-judge panel, and it normally still takes a number of months before a decision comes down. Meanwhile, Brendan sits in prison. Stephen, meanwhile, has a new attorney, Kathleen Zellner, also based here in Chicago, and she is doing some testing on some of the physical evidence from the scene and in the hopes that she can determine newly discovered evidence that would allow her to file a motion for a new trial or she's even hoping that she could actually prove who the real perpetrator is.
That's the bottom line here, is to find out who really killed Teresa Halbach, isn't it?
It is. It does neither the Halbachs nor any victim in a case any good to have the wrong person sitting in prison while the real killer is out free. And that happens. And that's the other side of any wrongful conviction, is that it means the real perpetrator goes free. And the best example is in Stephen Avery's first wrongful conviction. The man who did commit that rape, because he wasn't arrested and prosecuted in the case that Stephen Avery was convicted of, he went off and raped at least one other woman. He was a suspect in a homicide in North Carolina. So, justice requires the truth, and people shouldn't be afraid of what it takes to get to that truth, even if it takes many years and if it means reopening some wounds of the victim's family as well.
You said to Wendy and I off mic, don't despair. Things are looking up. Things are getting better. Explain why.
Yeah, and I talk about this in the book towards the end. There's some suggestions and ideas that we can all do. We need to take more ownership in what happens in our own criminal justice system. It's not just Manitowoc County, some distant county, where these kinds of things happen. They happen everywhere. They happen all over the world. Dean and I have spoken to audiences in Europe, and we hear the same thing there. Partly in America, though, we have at least the right to, first of all, in a lot of states, you elect judges. In every state, you elect sheriffs and prosecutors. And those elections happen, though, in off-cycle elections where very few people turn out, 15 to 20%. And so what happens is most of the time they're unopposed. It's the same old people that keep winning. And then they sort of handpick their successors, and it goes on and on and on like that. But if people stand up and say, we don't want to do business the way we've been doing it before, they can make a difference. It just happened here in Chicago and in Cleveland and in Jacksonville, where the voters voted out of office longtime prosecutors who had run on the platform of, let's lock them up, throw away the key, the clanging cell doors in their TV commercials. And people said, we don't want to do it that way anymore. We want to be smart on crime. So people can make a difference at the ballot box if they really vote. The other thing is jury duty. Most people get this jury summons and they think it's like a root canal. It's the last thing they want to do.
Except for me, who got a summons and then they canceled all the court sessions that day and I got dismissed. I really wanted to be a juror.
Well, that happens sometimes too, but your being down there may have made a difference in a case getting resolved. Sometimes cases get resolved on the day of trial. Both sides become more reasonable, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
But it's a good thing to do.
It is a good thing. It's your civic duty. It's the only chance you can actually participate directly in the judicial branch. Mm-hmm. But you also keep in mind that you're not going to be necessarily a good juror on every single case. Let's say you have something in your a close family member or friend who was sexually assaulted, and you can't really put aside what you know about what happened in that case to be fair in others. Then you're doing your duty by telling the judge and the lawyers that, and you may very well be a perfect jury in some other kind of a case. But people do need to be willing to step up to the plate and serve as jurors, because it's a fundamental part of our whole system.
Good luck with the book, Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. This book will give us hope, hopefully.
Thank you.
Jerry Buting, you can follow him on Twitter. It's at Jay Buting.
Yes.
Correct? I just followed you. And you can see him at the Union League Club of Chicago, like in a half an hour this morning. And tonight, 7 p.m., Community Christian Church through Anderson's Bookshop. Continued success and good luck. What are you working on next?
I'm still a practicing lawyer, so I still have cases. I'm also trying to talk to as many people as I can and keep public awareness about what's going on in our criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
Good
Thanks,
luck, Jerry. To you.
Appreciate it. A quick break, some news, and then more show. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.